Podcast where liberty is our mission. Today is Tuesday, October 22nd, 2013, and this is podcast number 355. My name is Ben Stone, and with me today is a very special guest. I am honored to have Wendy McElroy with me on the phone. Wendy, welcome to the Bad Quaker podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me, Bad Quaker. I love your moniker.
I would, at this point, normally spend a few minutes saying, you know, this book and that book and this article and your work here and your work there. But folks, if you don't know who Wendy is, I don't know how you could be a listener of mine and not know who Wendy is. Wendy has been doing this for like 30 years. She is she's been fighting this fight since the days that I was going door to door with pamphlets trying to legalize marijuana when I had, you know, when I was just a pimply-faced kid. And Wendy, I really appreciate all the work you've done. One of the things that I wanted to mention right off the bat is your work, Benjamin Tucker and Liberty, a biographical essay, and I'll put a link to that in today's show notes. I was having trouble understanding Benjamin Tucker. I could pick up Spooner really easy. I could read other stuff really easy, but I just seemed to be struggling with Benjamin Tucker. And I found your article back, oh, like maybe 2004, 2005 or something, that you wrote way back in 81. And it just opened it up to me. It was like, how obvious, now I see. And it just laid it right out, and I really appreciate it. That was kind of like my introduction to your work, and I really appreciated that.
Well, that's terrific, because Tucker is one of my favorites. And don't blame yourself if he was more difficult to understand, because Tucker basically evolved over quite a period of time from natural rights, which he abandoned, to Stirnerite egoism, which he abandoned. And along the way, you know, a lot of the theoretical underpinnings of his how he approached politics and radicalism, you know, shifted pretty dramatically. Tucker, as you look at him on the issues, however, is far more consistent. And I always found him to be by far the most fascinating of the 19th century individualist anarchists. And I don't put Spencer or anything in that category, but unless, of course, you focus on The Right to Ignore the State, one of my favorite essays.
He was, I hate to say, he wasn't really a student of Spooner's, but he was heavily influenced by Spooner, right?
He called him my mentor, and he really did. If you ever read the eulogy that Tucker wrote for Spooner, it comes through very clearly that he loved the man. And it's as much about the love that he felt for Spooner, that he was a gentle giant, that he always had time to speak to people, to students, and he disagreed with him, of course, on things like intellectual property, and very markedly on that subject. And he also disagreed on some of the arguments that were used to repudiate or reject voting. But yeah, a student and a mentor, I would say definitely.
I think it's interesting, too, that that Tucker and Spooner, being in that kind of a relationship, could have such opposite ideas about intellectual property and yet remain civil and not have a giant split over it or anything like that. And at the same time, you know, libertarian thought was evolving during that time. And to a large extent, it's still evolving. You know, we still have we still struggle with things like IP among us. But they did it very civilly.
And that's impressive, because one of the things Tucker was not known for was the civility with which he treated people who had what he called foolish ideas. And the one jab that he took at Lysa and Spooner in Liberty was to call this the only foolish position that my mentor has ever taken. So he used he not merely called it foolish, but he used incredible tact, given that Tucker was not known for incredible tact. And I agree with you. IP right now is probably the cutting edge issue in libertarianism, and there's a lot of disagreement and debate. Interestingly enough, I think that it is very clear that the anti-IP position is winning. And this is almost unimaginable to me when I, or would have been when I started being one of two people I knew in the movement. And I have to say that I give Sam Konkin, the third, credit for being the first and influencing me. But he was one of he was the first, and I was out at about 1982. We were out, hawking the anti-IP position with all our hearts, and it was very well received in terms of how many people were interested, but very poorly received in how many people really thought this was a debate. They thought it was an interesting historical perspective. They thought there were some marginal, peripherally good points that they were convinced on by our arguments. But now it seems the opposite, that people who are advocating IP within the movement are the ones who are basically being dismissed at the foundation.
I think, with all the computer changes that have taken place in the last 10, 15 years or so, I think that enlightened the argument dramatically. I never thought of these things at all back in the 80s and even well into the 90s. It just never occurred to me until file sharing became a topic, and it caused me to really stop and reevaluate things. What would you say was the pivotal moment for you on that?
Well, the pivotal moment when I actually went from to anti-IP, from basically not considering the issue too deeply but being sort of pro-IP if I was pushed into a corner on it, was probably meeting Sam Konkin and reading Tucker. I think that for many people, very similar to you, the thing that's pushing them right now is that so much property is intellectual. With the internet, with technology, so very much is defined in terms of intangible property. And it's become so very aggressive, and so that it's become a way that people are controlling the world, is by owning patents on drugs that people need to stay alive, and by trying to control the internet. Open source, you mentioned, is one of the big passions of my husband, who is also anti-IP to an extreme. And I think people are seeing on a very practical level, because they see these communities, these open source communities play out, what richness there is and how progress itself is part and parcel of having a free flow of ideas. And that when you kill ideas by strapping them down with laws, what you're doing is you're killing human progress. And that you're killing human cooperation, because the cooperation's in the open source. It's not in the laws that basically make people be drugged to court because they downloaded a CD or whatever.
It's often mentioned that Rothbard, didn't really do a lot of in-depth writing on the topic. He did expose some things like how patents were illegitimate and how people like Eli Whitney used the patent process to hold back progress, not at all the version that the governments want us to believe, that patents, create incentives in the market. But even Rothbard, as recently as, just prior to his death, still didn't have a clarity on this. But again, to be fair, this whole file sharing thing hadn't exploded yet. So we've actually, as we were evolving in the 1800s with Tucker and Spooner and Spencer and these guys, we're kind of still doing that now, even in the days of Rothbard.
Rothbard didn't see everything we're talking about, and because of my great fondness for Murray, I'm inclined to give him a free pass, even though he was, like you said, kind of vague about IP. He sort of vaguely attacked it as a concept, but he didn't attack it as he generally did things, which were incisively and condemn it as, it's evil. It's evil, sweetie, is what he used to say to me in his squawky Brooklyn voice. evil. So, he never did that with IP. But like I said, let's give him a free pass because it's Murray.
Yeah, I think just personality alone, we can give him a free pass on that. But also, the great work that he did. Where would we be without him anyway?
I would not be I can't say that. I probably would have become an anarchist. I would have not become an anarchist when I did, because I met Murray in 1978, and I became an anarchist. And, of course, there was a lot of seeding done before that, a lot of, reading that made me susceptible to becoming an anarchist. But the tipping point of my anarchism was reading a little nothing article that Murray wrote for a little nothing newsletter called the article was called Do You Hate the State? And I started reading that as a wishy-washy advocate of limited government, and I came out an anarchist.
Yeah, I really liked that article. I actually republished that on Bad Quaker, one of the very early things we did when we very first set up the site. I really enjoy that article of his.
You have to put a link in so people can read it.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay.
I took a little heat from that, actually, because he had some criticism of a popular libertarian economist that had some words to say about that. But that's totally beside the point. Now, I wanted to quote something that you recently read. I'm sorry, that you recently wrote. And just kind of like get your thoughts on this. You said, and this is in reference to the government and the current things that we're seeing, the activities that we're seeing on a day-to-day basis nowadays. You wrote, like a raving beast that loses its fear of humans, government becomes more dangerous when it loses the need to pose as a public servant who performs legitimate tasks. In short, government becomes more dangerous when it doesn't care what you think of it. And, I read that back when you first wrote it, and then I reread it this morning in my notes, and I thought, holy cow, this is exactly what we're seeing around us on a day-to-day basis. It's like these predators in government almost don't care to put on the sheep's clothing anymore. They just bring out the teeth and just, do what they're going to do, and they don't care where the blood splatters.
I know. I introduced this, that article, with the idea that Murray used to always cackle with joy when politicians were so blatant, because he thought, the mask is dropping, sweetie, and it's, he always celebrated it, and always had the different reaction, the opposite reaction. It was rather like Sam Konkin. Used to always advocate the worse it gets, the better it gets, because people will rise up the worse it gets. Well, I always figured the worse it gets, the worse it gets. And I always figure a politician who wants my goodwill and wants my vote will harm me less in a very blatant outward manner than someone who doesn't. It's rather like a friend whose purpose of being associating with you is to harm you, to take advantage of you. And he has to convince you on some level that he's your friend. He can't take you out into a back alley and beat you to a pulp, because that action is so antithetical to anything that is friendship that, you wake up and you say, oh my God, this person is really out to harm me. And then your cooperation and the access to your life that you so willingly give disappears. And government is like that friend who doesn't really, if he can get what he wants from you through cooperation, would rather get that than taking you out and beating you in the alley, because that makes the mask drop. That means he has lost from his arsenal the ability to trick you into cooperation. And you're seeing with police right now, I'm not making any kind of, the good old days with the police. The police were always enforcement arms of the state and thugs, but they didn't do things like go out and do SWAT raids on 82-year-old grandmothers and shoot her dog on the way, her little poodle on the way in, just because they can. the mask is dropping with the militarization of the police, with, you know, and you could go down a long list. They don't need to pretend that they are performing a service for you anymore. They are thugs. They will act like thugs. And that's the difference between America in the 50s, where they had to pretend massively that, you know, well, they taxed you, and the Soviet Union, where, you know, there was no pretense at all. And as, even as an anarchist, I hope it's not considered heresy, I'd prefer to live in the America of the 50s.
It's kind of like, well, I guess this really is the case. There's less and less education among the government and the thugs and the goons and so forth. And they don't realize things like, you know, Machiavelli warned how many hundreds of years ago was that? That you can't treat a people like this and still remain the prince over them. You have to keep up the appearance that the people need you and that you're benevolent and you're there on their behalf. And the moment that that facade falls away, then the only thing you have left is just blatant aggression to try to keep them pounded back and held in control.
Yeah, exactly. One of my favorite writers was Etienne Laboisie in The Politics of Disobedience, which basically was a book addressed to why people obey and how do you get them to obey. And he goes through all the machinations that government goes through, including bread and circuses, legitimizing itself. In Laboisie's day, the legitimacy came from being appointed by God through births and a monarchy. Today it becomes from being appointed by the modern God, which is the will of the people, if you believe that elections really express that and are not either rigged or so poorly attended. They don't represent much of anything. But nevertheless, yeah, without legitimacy, the government is revealed to be what it is, which is a ravaging beast.
I think the same. I think the media is facing the same problems that government is facing right now, as we see more and more, you know, the falsities that the media portrays and how their lies just compound on each other, and they're becoming more and more obvious as people on the internet are able to take things apart on a moment by moment basis and catch them in their lies. And I think that the exposure of that is doing the same thing to media. It's just putting them in a position where they, every time they lie, somebody points it out.
There's that, and the internet. You know, thank goodness for the internet. There's also getting to be more and more a cognitive dissonance between what you hear on, I don't care what you listen to, CNN, Fox. I mean, you get different lies. You know, I sometimes listen to CNN and then Fox just because I want to hear the different lies, how things are being lied about differently. But the thing that people are seeing right now is the dissonance between not the internet and the media, but their own lives and what the media says. Things are getting better. Obamacare is less expensive. You have more choice. People are finding how expensive Obamacare is. They find they have less choice. They find, you know, everything that they're being told translates into a lie of their own, the reality of their own experience. So that cognitive dissonance, I mean, it's like the Soviet Union when all you heard, bumper crops this year, bumper crops, on the media, and then people were starving on the streets and their rations were being cut, you know, month by month. There gets to be a point where, you know, you don't need the internet to know that what's being said isn't true.
I was walking by a television this morning, and there was no volume on. It was just the television with the news just flickering in the background. And I saw a chart pop up, and this guy was trying to explain that the housing market was improving on the average of about 11% per year and had since, you know, this so-called recovery. And I looked at that and I thought, that is completely a lie. My house lost a third of its value between 2006 and 2008, and it has still, it's holding at that, it's still lost a third of its value.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know of anybody whose homes have gone up in value. I don't know where this 11% increase per year is coming from.
It doesn't matter. They will say whatever they want to. It's crazy. It's like the studies. And they base things on strange studies. You go and you check one study out that I checked recently. I even forget what it was supposed to be proving. It'll come to me while I talk, probably. But I went back and checked it out, and it was based on a non-random sampling of something like 50 people. So it was a slop, you know, a self-selecting study. It was saying what they wanted to hear, so people ran with it. It was something about children and I think it was breastfeeding. Anyway, that kind of research and journalism, just what they do is they basically are going down White House agenda points, and they are so lazy, some of them, that all they do is basically literally rip what comes through from the White House and read it on air. And why not? I mean, they get advanced, they get payment, high-paying jobs, and they don't cause any trouble, which is what most people want.
You see this with the labor statistics all the time. There's like 20 different ways you can count the labor statistics, and they will count them. One party will count them the way they want to get the numbers they want to say. The other party will count them the way they want to get the numbers they want to say. But in reality, they're ignoring, you know, vast numbers of people that are just falling off of the number charts because they're either not looking for a job, or they've completely given up, or they're working, you know, a lesser job than they were. And so almost all of the numbers the media gives you on that are made up in one way or the other.
Even if you can trust the numbers that they get in, there are six categories of numbers that of labor that the Department of Labor looks at. And U3 is the one that's reported as the official unemployment rate by the media, and I include most print media in that. And that figure is people who have actively looked for work, I think, in the last 6 months or whatever, 3 months or 6 months. And you're right, it does not include U6. U6 are the people who stopped looking for work. They're the people who have part-time work, which, you know, usually they have to have two jobs or something, so sometimes they're counted twice in that category and inflates that category. It's a seasonal labor, things like that, seasonal unemployment. So you don't get anything like the picture that is reported by U3. Sometimes you kind of get the picture of U6 included with U3 because the Republicans want to make themselves look better by making the Democrats look worse, so they throw that in. But you know, that's something, too, that people on the street, it's getting to be, you don't have to be the Internet versus the media. People on the street know that it's a lie because they know how hard they're working. They know how much less they are making, and they know that their boss is telling them, look, you know, I'm going to cut your hours again.
I'm going to break us here for a commercial break, and folks, stick with us. I'll be right back with Wendy McElroy. Do you have an Amazon account? If you don't, let me encourage you to set one up. Setting up an account is free and it's easy. Amazon has great prices, and in most cases, you can avoid paying sales tax. Plus, if you're careful and lump your purchases together, you can even get free shipping. And Amazon has almost anything you can think of, plus it's safer and cheaper than driving all over town. When you buy stuff, if you follow the Amazon link at badquicker.com, Amazon will give badquicker.com a tiny portion of the purchase price. It won't cost you any extra, but you will be supporting this podcast. Thank you.
Need to talk to people in a secure manner? Liberty Private Network sells phones that will work over any good internet connection and give you military-grade encryption for calls that cannot be tapped. Great for lawyers and clients, business people with trade secrets, or just ordinary folk who don't want their love talk spied on by some scumbag from the central scrutinizer. Call 516-TLK-SAFE on your non-secure phone and tell them the Freedom Fiends sent you. That's 516-TLK-SAFE.
Thanks for sticking with us through the commercial. This is Ben Stone with Wendy McElroy. And we were talking about how the government is sort of dropping its mask, and it's sort of it's revealing itself. And also we were talking about how, to a large extent, the mask of legitimacy that the media has is falling away with time. As this takes place, Wendy, a lot of people, I hear this just I would say way too often, I hear people say something in the reference to a second American Revolution or a coming American Revolution or a new American Revolution. And I just, I get cold shivers when I hear that, because I really think this is an expression of vast ignorance on the people that are saying it. I hate to be rude, but I really think it's ignorance on the people who are saying it. And you made a statement once. You said that if a second American Revolution happens, it's going to look a lot more like a second French Revolution than a second American Revolution.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me, I agree with, I still agree with myself. How amazing. But let me begin by saying, even if it were to look like an American Revolution, that would be terrible, because from my view, the American Revolution was not a revolution at all. It was a civil war. And one of the things people don't realize, one of the things that is not really taught very much in American schools, is about 25% of the population left. And they left because they were dispossessed of property, that because they had the political opinion, it doesn't matter whether they took up arms or not, or whether they were active in opposing the rebels. They, because of their position of being monarchists, they were tarred and feathered, their homes were burned, their property was massively confiscated. Even the American Revolution created, you know, and quite apart from the people who had to flee and populate Canada largely, most of the area I live in right now, because I am Canadian in Ontario, was populated by loyalists. The American Revolution gave rise to drafts, to fiat currency, to more government than existed before the British were there. So I think that even those who look at the American Revolution and are correct in saying it could reoccur are incorrect in thinking that this would be like an overwhelmingly good thing. It would be bloody, it would be more government, and it would be a very unfortunate occurrence. Having said that, I think the French Revolution is more likely to play out for a number of reasons. One is the American Revolution, as much as I've just dissed it, had a huge advantage in that it was a rebellion against a distant, ill-represented government. The British really had very little representation compared to the French Revolution, the French, for example, who had a class system, a caste system, very established, entrenched oppression, very established, entrenched taxes. There were more taxes in France at the time before the French Revolution, I think, than I've ever seen. I mean, it was amazing, the taxation level. By contrast, I mean, the American Revolution rebelled against the stamp tax. It was pretty much an absentee government that they were rebelling against. And that's not the case now. If they rebel, they will rebel against the government in their own backyards that is entrenched, strong, militarized, and it will be far more like the people basically rising up, throwing over the government. And that may sound like a good thing, especially from the mouth of an anarchist like me, but, you know, it doesn't lead to good things. The use of force, Gandhi kept saying that the ends are the means in progress, that if you want ends that are peaceful and cooperative, you need a process that is nonviolent. And if, you know, those who live by the sword die by the sword is basically what he was saying. And I fear that he is correct. Perhaps some good could come of it, but I hope that's the very last alternative and certainly not something that people hope for and you know, yell and yell, yay, revolution. If nothing else is available, then yay, revolution, but, you know, I'm not enthusiastic.
I think a lot of people forget that, you know, it's really a truthful statement that war is the health of the state. And revolution is just really, you know, swapping one leader for another, swapping one government for another, and you still maintain the myth of the state. It's still, you haven't won out anything. You've just, you know, in comes the new boss, same as the old boss.
Pretty much. And what you do lose out is the dislocation of a lot of institutions that, and a lot of property that was rightfully held, and that it's very sorry to see it, right? Like with the American Revolution, so much of the loyalist population was just hounded out of existence in the United States, had to flee from their for their lives, mostly to Canada, some to the Caribbean, some to Mexico. What you get with any war or revolution is what you get with any kind of upsurge of violence or government policy. The average person suffers. And so that's basically why I'm not an advocate of even a second American Revolution, which is very unlikely.
I think a lot of people, when they look back and they look back in history and they kind of have, you know, rosy glasses, and they think of this government school version of history, and they don't realize that not only, you know, all the wealth and all the property that the Loyalists had was basically stolen by those who stayed. But then in addition to that, the actual poorer people who were in the military, a lot of them had their land taken by the aristocrats, the people like Hamilton and guys like that, the bankers and so forth that had all their money schemes. And a lot of the soldiers that were in the trenches facing the worst aspects of the war came back home to find out that the new property taxes that never existed before meant that now they don't have a farm. And it literally robbed from not only the Loyalists that had to flee, but the actual soldiers who were giving the greatest sacrifice of all, it robbed them as well.
It robbed them in another way. What you're saying is absolutely valid, but it robbed them in another way, too. The payment that they were supposed to receive for being, you know, in the militias and going and putting their lives on the line and in absolutely wretched conditions, leaving their families who were vulnerable to attack because it was a civil war. There were British troops here and there, but it was a civil war as much as anything else. The people against the people, with about 25% of America wanting the British absentee government to continue as it was. The payment that they were supposed to receive for being in the trenches became a fiat money that, if they got it all, was worth next to nothing. That old phrase, not worth a continental, comes from the continentals that were basically the payment for so many soldiers. And by the time the paper money had been issued, no one was accepting it. It was, you know, they couldn't buy anything with it. So even if they could pay the taxes that were being levied at ruinous rates on the farms, they didn't have the money to do so with, because it was not being accepted. And I think the reason a lot of people don't know that there were such bad conditions in the American Revolution, it was such a brutal war, that it wasn't all about, you know, celebrating and parades in the streets, you know, yay, the British are coming and we win. Is the American Revolution is part and parcel of the mystification of the state. One of the reasons that, you know, all these trappings have gone through, and the trappings of history as well as the trappings of office, like taking the oath of office, has gone through on an uninterrupted chain from Washington crossing the Delaware to Washington taking the first oath of office, is because that's part of what legitimizes the government today. And so they would be very, very loath to have public schools teach that part of what legitimizes them, the revolution, was really a pretty shady, dubious matter that had a whole lot of injustice, probably as much injustice as anything that was a blow for freedom.
Yeah, that reminds me of an article you did way back in 95 called Demystifying the State, and that's a really good article. If I can remember to do it, I'll put a link in today's show notes for that one, too.
Well, thank you.
A lot of people don't realize it, but you're one of the early people who took on the title of voluntarist, and that's a word that's really catching on with all the kids these days. But you were calling yourself that, you know, a long time ago.
Well, in 1982, Carl Wattner, George Smith, and myself had meetings in a small living room in Hollywood, California, and we wanted to come up with a group. The LP was very active at that point. Ed Clark was about, and he had been making, you know, the most, he had received the most votes. I think that was the time frame. He'd received the most votes that the LP ever received before or after that point. And there was a big upsurge that was drawing a lot of attention, and we were very, the three of us were very aware of the anti-political roots of libertarianism and how, in fact, they're not just, we're not just critical. We think that there's an incompatibility, moral and strategically, between politics, electoral politics, and libertarianism, and certainly between anarchist libertarianism. So we came up with an organization that was specifically aimed at countering political arguments, but not being so negative as to make that our be-all and end-all. We wanted to come up with strategies of how you can advance liberty, truly advance it, in a free market voluntary manner, including the construction of alternate private institutions that can replace things like the post office and other government so-called services. And the three of us were basically fishing for a title for it, and basically we fell back on Auberon Herbert's use of the word voluntarist, which was the most popularizing modern use of it, I think, with Herbert being a 19th century radical individualist in Britain around the turn of the 20th century. And he's a wonderful, wonderful figure, I think very underrated in the movement. How many people I remember, that was the first time in the contemporary movement since about Auberon Herbert that the word voluntarist was used. And we came out with a newsletter which, you know, Carl, you know, bless his heart, works incredible hours and then comes home and does incredible work for the movement. He has maintained the newsletter since the early 1980s through to today, and I highly recommend people go to his website, The Voluntarist, and check it out, because it is a magnificent resource. But we've all heard back from, especially Murray, who just thought it was a ridiculous name, and people like, it was, you know, a butt of a lot of jokes. So it's very gratifying to see on the internet or Facebook, you know, half the people who want to befriend me are named, you know, Frank Voluntarius Upstart or something. it's very, very nice.
You should take that as a compliment. It's amazing, really, how many of them are out there.
Well, if people want to befriend me on Facebook and you want to be a sure thing, throw voluntarist into your name somewhere.
In this demystifying process, I think one of the really powerful things is more and more people getting their children out of public schools. I think that's a big step in breaking that myth. What's your opinion on that?
I think it's huge. And I think there is going to be a big crackdown, especially in homeschooling. The government is not so concerned about private schools because it pretty much can regulate them. If not into, you know, poor quality of education, into at least conforming to certain curriculum. And you see now so many people homeschooling, and it blows me away because, I mean, these people, not only do they pay twice, you know, they're paying taxes to send their kids to public schools, but they're also paying, if they send them to private schools, as a clear payment, but they're also paying if they homeschool by making one parent unemployable sometimes. They, in terms of their investment of time and some money invested in tools of education, and they just, it's a, to them, it's a no-brainer. They love their children so much, they care for them so much, that they will not hand them into a meat factory, which suppresses all kinds of any kind of critical thinking and any kind of individual spark, which is what public schools are right now. They process meat. So homeschooling, I'm seeing in articles I'm reading and in news items, there's a real concerted press in certain states to have curricula imposed upon homeschoolers and have them, I think the core curriculum, you know, the common core that's coming out of the federal government, part of it addresses the idea of imposing these federal standards on homeschoolers who have to have their children trained and tested to comply with certain standards that are hideous if you read the Common Core standards they're putting out. So there's going to be a war on that, I think. And the reason there's a war on it, it is such a bright spot and it is so heartening. And we're not the only ones who realize it. They do too.
Yeah, I don't know if you're seeing this in Canada or not, but it's really disturbing here. More and more as I drive around the countryside, my wife and I have a motorhome and an RV, and we travel around quite a bit. And the more that we travel, the more I see these giant mega schools being built, and they just in every way look exactly like the federal penitentiaries that you drive by on the highways. The difference between the two is becoming less and less obvious. When you're driving by one, you just don't know if you're looking at a prison or a high school. And in another way, that's more of that mask, more of that demystifying of the state, more of the mask falling away. But it's still just a terrifying thing to see the treatment of the kids more and more like they're prisoners.
Well, and the inside, they're getting more like penitentiaries because of the presence of police and the presence of guards everywhere and the shakedown of lockers, which, you know, no one even questions, should we have a warrant anymore? No one, and you know, drug testing. These things are almost not questioned, and, you know, they would have been just unthought of, unheard of, when we were going to school. And that's how far, I kind of worry about this generation that's growing up, because they're going to know nothing but this, and they're going to take it as a given that when you go to the airport that you're not a customer, you're a police suspect, and that to get on a plane, you have to be physically molested by someone, you know, a stranger in a uniform. It makes it okay if the person is molesting a child, as long as they're wearing a uniform.
That's quite a thought. That stuns the mind.
I hope it does. What makes me fear is that it will not stun a generation who is brought up to expect this and considers it normal.
Shifting gears a bit, it would be I would really be disappointed if I had the opportunity to talk to you and I didn't bring up this topic. By 2008, I had given up on electoral processes and voting and all this kind of a thing. And then I felt under so much peer pressure, so much, you know, team mentality, that I actually went back down, registered for the primaries, and voted in 2008. And even then, the day that I went down and voted in the primary for Ron Paul in 2008, I just felt so dirty. I felt like I had just done something that I knew in my heart, I knew was immoral. And I was really kind of thrilled when I found some of your writings on the topic. And I felt like, yeah, okay, I'm not just losing my mind. This really is a moral choice here. And I had to take it through then and pick it apart in my brain, because you've had some heat over this and you've had this argument thrown at you. Essentially, if you're a slave and you have, and I'm going to quote some terminology, but if you have one overseer named Goody and one overseer named Batty, and you get to choose between overseer Goody and overseer Batty, then there's nothing morally wrong with you making that choice. But, you know, that's really, first off, from logic, that's called begging the question. It's setting up a question in a specific way so that you get the answer that you want to begin with. And that's not really a legitimate way to think things through. I guess I'll just shut up and let you take the reins from there, because you sort of wrote the book on this.
Well, you know, that I hear that analogy all along, and that goody-baddy terminology comes from Walter Block, and he and I have a long tradition of disagreeing on this subject. You know, we have a long friendship, too. The thing is not whether – I think that that analogy approaches things from the wrong perspective. Perspective is not there's an evil up there, and you know, which do you vote for, the lesser of two evils? I know that, in fact, you can first of all, the position being facilitated, whether you're a slave owner, holder, owner, slave master, or a politician, is unjust. And even though I have a right morally, it's a moral case, even though I have the right morally to vote someone into an unjust position over my life and make the choice, this person would be more acceptable to me in this unjust position than the other person, I have no right to make that choice for anyone else. And I have no right to assume that the person standing beside me agrees with my choice or has given me their power of attorney, so to speak, to vote for them. When I facilitate someone into a position where I know they will oppress innocent third parties who have not consented, then I'm part and parcel of that oppression because I am facilitating it. Now, you may say the electoral system, my vote doesn't count, this and that. It counts. If it doesn't count in terms of actually counting and contributing to the numbers, even if you tore up the ballot and threw it over your shoulder, it counts because it legitimizes the position. Why do you think politicians are desperate and spend mega billions in the process of saying, get out the vote, rock the vote, come and vote, it's your duty to vote. That's all you'll be hearing. That's all you do hear. They say that because it is absolutely essential to them. If no one voted, they would have no legitimacy whatsoever in that office. If two people vote and they get 100% of the vote, they can say, I have a mandate, even though two people in a town of 3 million voted, those two people have legitimized the government. They have legitimized their office, and they need that. So, and their office, they will go on the basis of those people voting to pass laws that oppress every other citizen. So you are an intimate part of the process of oppression if you basically consent to power over others. And the specific analogy of the slavery, voting for two slave owners has always been very strange to me, because you're saying, in some sense, it's, you know, the whole office of slavery and slave owner and voting for it has meaning only in the sense that you are putting up a position of that's very, very unjust. And by focusing on the process, by turning the slaves against each other, if they don't vote the right way, don't vote for the right slave master, I think you're shifting the whole discussion away from what's essential. Should anyone be a slave owner? Should anyone have that position of power? And you're taking as a given that there are only two alternatives here between goody and baddie, rather than pulling out the whip out of the guy's hand and whipping both of them across the face and having a slave insurrection or having slave mass escape or just having no one be voted for and goody and baddie duking it out with each other and hopefully they kill each other.
I think it's really obvious if you look at countries where, you know, we have some oppression here in the U.S., there's oppression in Canada, there's oppression in Mexico, but when you go to some countries where there's a very clear dictator who has an iron fist and he's really obvious, they almost always have real close to 100% voting. It's mandatory. In some cases, they'll even hold back food supplies and so forth if the people don't vote. And that in and of itself should indicate that this whole idea of voting has behind it some type of a bad. Even if you don't think the whole thing through, it should be obvious that you know, if people won't come out and vote voluntarily to support the government and show that the myth is real, then they'll come and force you to do it. And I think even in the United States, I can foresee at some point in the future where, you know, maybe you won't be allowed to have a driver's license if you don't vote, or maybe you won't be allowed to collect Social Security or welfare or unemployment or something if you don't vote.
It's strange because I've had a similar thought. One of the things that has changed in terms of the whole voting process and protocol and everything like that is it's being much more closely linked to government programs. Now, right now, it is linked in a voluntary manner, but that's how things always start. I mean, it always starts a very modest little government agency, and all of a sudden you have the you know, Department of Labor, you have the Department of Education, you have, you know, and there are these crushingly huge things, including, you know, partnerships with unions, and everything starts modestly. I'm thinking, for example, of the Obamacare registration, which facilitates and stops in place and asks everyone, do you want to register for the vote? That is, in and of itself, I mean, it's voluntary, but in and of itself, it's rather strange. I've not seen before programs, and I've seen it, that not just Obamacare, I've seen it in the census, for example, that was done, gave you the opportunity to register to vote. That's a linking of government programs with the idea of you should vote. I mean, it's your duty to vote. They wouldn't put in, you know, do you want to buy a gallon of milk in there, because it's not your government favored duty to you know, buy milk, but they want you to vote. I can see the day when it no longer is voluntary, where it's mandatory, and perhaps they will do things like link them to passports. They've linked so much to passports right now down in the States. That kind of thing could happen.
I wouldn't be surprised at all. To kind of shift directions once again, it would be unfair of me to have you on my show and not bring up the fact that your work in feminism. And I was going to throw out the phrase at you, accidental feminist.
Yes.
What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I wrote an article called The Accidental Feminist. I was toying with calling it, I never meant to be a feminist, and because that captures it. I always took the point of view when I was young, when I was like in my teens and early 20s, that it made no sense to break libertarianism into libertarian feminism and the rest of the movement or what, because all individuals, all people, have the same rights, exactly the same rights, to the same degree, simply by being human. So what are we talking about? What special, what different rights would I advocate by being a woman than just by being a human being? But I hope people don't think less of me. I became a feminist because I was offered a book by Cato Institute, edit a book on feminism and liberty, feminism, and the state. And I was so hungry at that point. I was trying to make it as a writer. I thought, yes, I will write on any subject you give and give you a competent book. And then I sat down and said, what the hell am I going to do? Because, you know, I'd never given this subject some thought. You know, I had written a few articles. I wrote an article on abortion that was very well received. And at that point, that time, if you wrote a really good piece on something, you became the expert, because there were not that many people writing, especially about feminism, which was a tangential issue. And places like Cato were very eager to have women and black and minority writers, because they were being bombarded by criticism about being, you know, the rich white male, you know, elite system. So, in any case, I got that opportunity. I started to sit down and read the history of individualist feminism. Mary Wollstonecraft, the anti-slavery abolitionist women who were just heroic in the turn of the century, in the 1800s, in America. And the first thing that happened is I started to gain a real appreciation of the women that came before me, and understand that one of the things, even though human nature may not divide us into men and women and with different rights, government certainly has at certain periods of life and history. And these women were made into a category, a political separate category, by government, and they were heroic. They were heroines in how they responded. I also came to realize that, so the pride of my own history, and the realization of the rebellion of government being part of why the feminism was necessary, rebellion against government. And then I realized there were certain issues that, quite frankly, are dealt differently and will be dealt differently forever, probably, between men and women, a key one being reproduction, because I would be the one to carry a child, and it would be my body. And even though I think that men who who are fathers or potential fathers are much neglected as a category of people with certain legitimate interests and perhaps even some kind of rights, I would still be the primary person to carry the child, and it would be mine, and the rights issue would be dramatically different. So I started to have more of appreciation of the whole feminist carving out of territory. And then, of course, one of the other things that happened is I looked around me, especially as the, you know, the 70s and 80s developed, and I realized that if I am, as a feminist, calling for equality of treatment and recognition of rights under just law, and just law being law that promoted the person and property and protected the person and property of people, then in fact what I had to do was argue against mainstream feminism and for explicitly individualist feminism, because men were being oppressed by mainstream feminism. The tables had been turned, and an honest feminist right now would have to do things like go to family court and advocate for the men.
In a way, I've been talking about for a while invading other movements and bringing the voluntarist perspective into other movements. And I have talked about some other people, like, for instance, in the farm food category, my good friend Eddie Free has sort of invaded that movement and is bringing the voluntarist perspective into it. And it's such a superior way of thinking. It's such a superior philosophy that a lot of these farmers are just grabbing right onto it. And you get somebody like Eric Peters, who is doing the same thing in the auto review category, and somebody like Cody Wilson that's getting into the computer, the hacking, hacktivism type way of thinking. And more people in other established groups and other established movements are getting the message of voluntarist, and they're realizing that the philosophy is a superior philosophy than their old, maybe more socialist or some other way of thinking that they had. And I think that's what you've done for feminism. You have, 30 years ago, you invaded feminism with voluntarist thought, and you're just driving right into there in a way that I don't think, to my knowledge, I don't think anybody else has done. I really appreciate your work there.
That's interesting. I've never thought of that way, that I was introducing voluntarism into feminism, but in fact, you're right. I think that's absolutely correct. So, and thank you. There's a lot of good people coming up right now, and I'm really happy, frankly, to have other people handle the whole idea of feminism, including some people from men's rights. I know men's rights has been bashed, and sometimes deservedly so, for being angry. But I've met an awful lot of people talking about, you know, invading or introducing yourself into different movements. I've met a lot of men's rights people who are there because of the injustice, and they're so relieved to hear women stand up and have principled approaches that say, yes, this is an injustice that you cannot see your child. Yes, it is an injustice that you are paying for child support and spousal support, and yet you've lost your job, and you know, you have to go living almost in a boarding house to support someone who won't let you see your child and is living in great style in the house that you had to abandon. The family law is so unjust that they are open to these arguments, and they are, as you say, if they're not angry, they want a just solution. There's so many movements right now, like you mentioned, you know, the farm movement. I didn't know that was going on, and yay, that's wonderful. And there's so many movements like the men's rights movement, the father's rights movement, the homeschooling, that are so receptive to the idea of voluntarism. And, I don't care if we were laughed at, in 1982. The fact is, it is far more accepted statement of principle, I am a voluntarist, in the mainstream than saying I am an anarchist.
Yeah. Very true. I want to mention at least two of your websites. That's one is wendymcelroy.com. It's just WendyMcelroy.com. And the other, iFeminist, iFeminists, one S on the end,
yeah.
.com, or .net, either one will get you there. Any other websites that you'd like to mention, or any upcoming projects that need attention?
Well, I'm basically getting involved. I don't think I'm telling tales out of school. I'm getting involved in what's a very exciting project called Liberty.me that is under the aegis of the incredible Jeff Tucker, with whom I have worked many times in the past, and I'll always sign on to anything that project, any project that man brings up. It's going to be a very ambitious program of information and widely networked websites that are maintained by people that Jeff appoints. I'll be among them, and giving basically the mechanics, the tools of freedom, how to not merely the intellectual ammunition, though with Jeff and I being involved in it, there's going to be an awful lot of intellectual ammunition on those sites and a lot of grounding and the importance of things like, for example, one of the things I'm going to be writing in the next week is a guide to the idea of prepping, and it's going to be called The Essential of Liberty Prepping. And I've been doing this myself for a long time. I'm very big on living freedom. And part of living freedom is, of course, I think, preparing yourself to be independent. And I know it's usually phrased as economic collapse preparation, but I think it's far more important than that. I think that one of the reasons people are dependent upon the state is because they've lost the skills. They've lost the anticipation of having to take care of yourself. And I'm not talking about people necessarily growing things from seeds in the ground. I do, and I enjoy it, but if other people don't, then don't do it. But they should have an expectation of taking care of themselves by you know, stocking up a little bit, or by learning how to take care of everything from their own communications by being a ham radio operator, which I am, or learning the skill of how to make minor repairs on your car. This is, of course, a very good thing just in and of itself to make yourself independent, but it's going to become more and more important to maintain your independence, your self-respect, and your self-reliance against the state, who is more and more trying to take over everything, including health care. I have heard from my husband, who was reading a newspaper item this morning, that non-profit, not-for-profit hospitals are basically confronting being almost run out of business by Obamacare by having to meet certain requirements, including the need to every 3 years prove that they are providing essential services that an Obamacare hospital is not in their area. They're actually trying to get rid of, you know, non-profit places where people can go and get health care for free. I expect there to be a huge push against alternative medicine, because alternative medicine is also a challenge to Obamacare. So knowing how to take care of yourself, knowing how to take care of your health, that's the kind of prepping that you need to do. It used to be that you set up private institutions to counter the services that government was supposed to be offering you, and that was a route to freedom. Each one of us has to be a little institution unto ourselves and create within ourselves the ability to look and at our lives and say, here there is no state, by which we mean here there is no need for a service that the state offers. We can network, we can do it ourselves, we can be a community, or we can be individuals who stand alone. But we need to say, here there is no state.
Boy, I couldn't agree with that more, and it's always good to hear that Jeffrey Tucker's got a new project going. He is the most frequent guest on BadQuaker.com, and he's a good friend, and I really like Jeffrey. I like sitting and just talking with him. But, Wendy, I wish I had a lot more time today. I'm going to have to cut it off. I really do appreciate you coming on the show with me. And I want to extend an open invitation. Anytime that you want to come back on, just drop me a note.
Oh, I'd love to. I'd love to. Thank you for having me. And goodbye, everybody. Take care.
Thank you very much. And, folks, thanks for listening today. And remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot. Thank you.